Bring Air Marshal Dunlap on the 13th of May, 1980. Good morning.
Good morning, Bill. I think the last time we talked with one another, I was telling you about some of the experiences at the outbreak of war, immediately on the outbreak. And one thing I mentioned was the fact that I happened to be orderly officer for the week, and which meant that I had to do all the codes and ciphers as well as my regular work of trying to build up the armor of the squadrons and the schools and everything else across Canada under crisis basis. I didn't complete the story, which I suppose I should mention that, of course, this arrangement of orderly officer doing code and ciphers was a purely peacetime arrangement. I happened to be caught in the transition between peace and war because one of the first things that was introduced, and it was essential that it be introduced, was that a proper code and cipher office be established and a regular team of code and cipher experts sufficient in size to run the office around the clock. That's not to say that there weren't code cipher people in peacetime, but they're only enough for the daily routine hours, and it was the after hours that they hardly have to manage. So very quickly there was an expansion there, and this nonsense of one individual having to labor through the night trying to do code and ciphers.
I think it didn't take too long to train somebody for this job. It was fairly routine.
No. The way things were done at that stage, it didn't take too long, because they were using fairly simple coding systems. That is relatively simple compared to those that were introduced just a little bit later on. Of course, before very long, when I get into the machine ciphers and online ciphers, so that the coding and the decoding was done, I guess you would describe it as automatically. And that greatly altered the activities of the office, and took the laborious part out of code and ciphering, and at the same time it introduced much more precise and practically unbreakable codes and ciphers. There's no code and cipher. There's no code yet been devised. I guess it hasn't been. It isn't breakable, but some of them are damn difficult to break, and it might take months or years to do it. So as long as you keep changing your codes every so often, you make it very tough for an enemy ever to break.
Yeah, did I understand you to say the other day that you did not have encoding or decoding machines, or did you, or were they very very basic ones?
They were absolutely basic. Mm-hmm. They were what I referred to as the punch board type. You know, where you put a stylus in a hole and pull, and put a stylus pull, and you convert the code symbol into the correct letter symbol. By that means, so you have to do, if you have a message that's 10 feet long and thousands of words, and tens of thousands of letters, just think of the.
I'd rather not really. Yeah.
Okay. 1939. I guess I better say a few words about my own office and department. Up until the outbreak of war, I was on the staff of Air Commodore Bredner as his armament advisor. That was a one-man show. There was an armament advisor, a signals advisor, a photographic advisor, and each of us was a one-man operation, navigation advisor, too. But, of course, with the outbreak of war, those quickly had to become fairly sizable operations. It was expansion in all those fields was going to be rapid, and it required extra help to take care of all the tasks. So, before many days or weeks passed, the so-called armament advisor and his office became the directorate of armament, and I was the director of that small department. There weren't too many armament officers available in Canada and the RCF in those days, so it wasn't too easy to lay hands on the staff that I needed. However, there had been sufficient expansion in the two or three years prior to war that I was able to draw a few members of staff into my office without depleting the staff of the armament school and the staff of the armament, the number of armament officers required for the various operational headquarters. For example, Eastern Air Command had an armament staff, Western Air Command had an armament staff, and I presume, even the training command had one armament specialist on staff. So I had to be careful not to deplete them while building up my own staff. So we built up fairly gradually. I had, before long, I think it's right to say, I'm just trying to think back now, I had a wing commander, I had a squadron leader as my deputy. At that time I was a wing commander. A squadron leader as my deputy, and I had a couple of flight lieutenants and a flying officer on staff there, right there at the beginning. And in addition to that, I had one or two field operators. It was necessary, it was very necessary to have somebody operating for me out in the field because my directorate was responsible for certain schools being formed under the BCATP, British Columbia Training Plan. For example, the bombing and gunnery schools were they weren't, I shouldn't say they were my responsibility because all schools under the training plan came under the director of training. And before very long that became elevated to an air member for training under Leckie, who was on loan from the RAF. But my responsibility for the schools was to see that they were open on time, and B, to see that the ranges were properly chosen and developed. That's the bombing and gunnery ranges. Every one of those had to have a large bombing gunnery range. And I guess that was the extent of my responsibility, but in order to ensure that, when you had about 10 schools being instructed all at the same time, it required a good deal of work. Oh yes, and on the third task was to see that the equipment got in there on time. Now that wasn't really, again, my prime responsibility, but we were given dates by which these schools had to be in operation. And everybody who was concerned with that British Commonwealth Air Training Plan was determined that their schools are going to open on time, and that the pilots, if it was a pilot school, or the navigators, if it was a navigation school, or the bomb aimers and the air gunners were going to become available for operations overseas by the state of town.
Was the flow of necessary supplies and equipment fairly good, or did you have...
Oh, there were all sorts of problems involved there, yeah. And it really required somebody riding honcho all the time. It was such a big operation that even with the best intent at the various headquarters and command staffs, things could be overlooked. And that was the reason I had a field team. I had a field team going from school to school, seeing that things were arriving on time and that plans for the commencement of the training was in hand, that the people who were being sent there knew what they had to do, and so on and so on. You have no idea the number of problems you can run into there when you're building runways and building roads and building living accommodation and then getting that stuff from that stage into an equipped stage where they had what they needed to do their job.
Yeah, a tremendous amount of staff work going on.
And I was very fortunate. I had several excellent chaps on that job. One of them was Bob Cameron. Later became Air Vice Marshal Cameron. Not everybody's cup of tea, but when it came to laboring, and when it came to getting a job done, he had the ability to organize and ride herd on it. And he may have put a few people's backs up in the process, but you could rely on him to get the job done. And we had a lot of Americans up in the RCF at that time. They came up in great droves in the early part of the training plan it was long before the Americans were in war. And these were young, enthusiastic kids who were trying to build up their flying time to get a commercial license or something like that. A lot of them were in the category that they used to refer to as hangar rats, hanging around hangars in the U.S. airfields, hoping they could get a little flight here and a little flight there in return for their labors around the hangars or around the aircraft to build up their flying time. Well, there was a flood of them came up. Now that's not quite right to leave it at that. There were some of those boys that came out because they were anxious to get in the war. They were anxious to do something to counter what was taking place in Europe. I think that particularly applied to a lot of the lads that came out from Texas. But many of the others were there. Perhaps not quite so much from the spirit of adventure or the spirit of duty, or just to build up their flying hours. It meant that you got quite a variety of types. Some outstanding lads and some rather mediocre, but they could fly, or we could make them. We could soon make them capable of flying adequately to do the job, so, and they were therefore a tremendous help. Well,
were they part of the Commonwealth Air Training?
They became members of the Royal Canadian Air Force.
Oh, I see.
They were enlisted in the RCF.
They didn't train actually under the plan then, because...
Now these fellows they were so-called, in quotes, experienced pilots. And some of them were.
Yeah.
Some of them were quite good, but an awful lot of them could fly, but And it didn't take too long to bring them up to standard where they could act as staff pilots. They would be, for example, in the bombing and gunnery schools. There were an awful lot of them in the bombing and gunnery schools. There, you had to have pilots to fly the air gunners and the bomb aimers and the air observers who were under doing their armament training. They weren't pilots. They couldn't fly themselves. Somebody had to fly them. And in each of those bombing gunnery schools, we had about 100 aircraft, and which meant that you had to have about 100 or more pilots to fly them. And with the extremely rapid build-up from our strength, which I mentioned last time, at the outbreak of war, which was just a few thousands. It had built up, I guess, to 6,000 or 8,000 or something like that before the end of 1939. That was the overall strength of the Air Force, including the Auxiliary Force, We had to build up to a strength that could man about 100 new air stations, 100 new fields. And each one of those, bombing under school, as I just mentioned, had over 100 pilots. Mm-hmm. And when you multiply that, you can see there were 10 of those bombing under schools, and we had to find those sets quickly.
So these fellows,
and some of them came in from from the bush flying adventures in the Canadian wilds, and others came from World War I lands who wanted to get back in the show. They were too old to serve overseas, but yet they could be retreaded, as it was, the expression was used, and they were quite good on those staff jobs. I've got a little diversion there, because I was going to tell you that Cameron had one of these American lads who was a bit of an efficiency expert to travel with him on a lot of these trips. Between the two of them, they did a first-class job. And, he had a third lad, too. I don't know whether they actually overlapped or whether one replaced the other, but he had a lad from Hamilton, Spence Allen, who was, quite an efficient chap who was a troubleshooter and trouble spotter on those missions. And then there was another fourth one, Bill Peace, who had been a pilot in World War I, had been quite a famous hockey player in the NHL in the early days. Came from the Niagara Peninsula, a peach farmer. Bill came back to the service, and I had him out acting as the my field representative on the development of the bombing and gunnery ranges. And he was very useful in that field. He worked well with the Department of Transport, who again did a lot of our field work for us in acquiring property. The lands office of the Department of Transport did a fantastically good job in acquiring the properties required for airfields, the properties required for ranges, and properties required for schools and so on. They just threw themselves right into that, and they were extremely good. Well, Bill worked with them primarily, and to see that things were going on time and there weren't too many holdups there. And then, of course, getting ranges is no simple task. If you need to get to, you need about a couple of hundred square miles of land for a bombing gunnery range, or water, as the case may be. Sometimes I think you can get away with less than that, but for a good size range, you need about that. You had the problems of dealing with the fishermen. You had the problems of dealing with the landowners. You tried to get these in areas that were remote from normal activities.
Presumably they had to be somewhat open, though.
They had to be adjacent to airfields.
Yeah.
Airfields, so... It was no simple task, and it was not only the land acquisition, but and the problem with fishermen, but you had the problem with the bird sanctuaries, and not only bird sanctuaries, the preservation of bird life generally, and you had to deal with the bird lovers, and you had to deal with the animal lovers if you were likely to do anything that would hurt the habitat of animals, and so on, and so on. It took a lot of patience. And normally in peacetime, it took an endless time to get a range authorized. In wartime, you can cut through things a little bit more rapidly.
Yes.
You can't ride roughshod. You see, we weren't at the same crisis pitch here in Canada as they were in the UK, by any means. It wasn't easy, but... all in all, it went extremely well. So I had these few fellows in the field. I had built up in my office. I had an extremely good squadron leader there from the Royal Air Force who had been in armament all of his life, and he'd come over to help with the BCATP organization and operation, and we had him at the armament school for a while, and then I moved him up to the headquarters, and he was very helpful. And Wing Commander Lister was my right-hand man. He had been in armament for some time. I had, I guess Lister wasn't a wing commander then, he was a squadron leader in those days, or even a flight lieutenant perhaps, and I had flight lieutenant Hank Walker on my staff. He was a pilot who graduated back in about 1935, he was relatively young and new to the service. But he'd had armament training. Indeed, he'd been on one of the armament courses I'd given at Camp Borden. I think he was a graduate of McMaster University. He'd been a mathematician and majored in math there, and he got a master's degree in mathematics. Very fine chap. I'll tell you a story about him in a few minutes. I mention his name here just to sort of fade away. Well, that's enough about the staff. We, of course, were right from the beginning, and before the end of September, we're involved with the acquisition and, determining of schedules and requirements upon which we would base the acquisition of machine guns, bomb sites, gun sites, bomb racks, towing equipment for towed targets, targets themselves, camera guns, all that sort of thing, and all the spare parts that go there with. The BCATP, British Combat Air Training Plan, emerged as an idea before the end of September. By mid-September, there'd been proposals and counter-proposals about the build-up of training in Canada. And then before, it wasn't much beyond the middle of September that at least a third, if not a fourth, proposal emerged to go in for training in a much bigger way than had already been conceived. What had been talked of in the early part of September was pretty big, but the message, I guess, from Chamberlain to Mackenzie King, there was a proposal for something really big to involve the flying training operations, aircrew training operations of the UK and the major Commonwealth countries. And before very long, there was an agreement in principle to this idea. The details had to be worked out, but as I recall it, it was sometime early in October that there was agreement in principle that there would be this large training plan based in Canada, involving the UK, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and South Africa decided not to participate, so it was just those four countries, and of course it involved other nationalities in the UK in sending students over, and we of course sent a number of foreign nationals of other countries that were sympathetic to, that had been invaded by Germany.
And Poles and Czechs.
And yeah, and we had the training of Norwegians, we had a lot of Norwegians and so on. I guess I'm not right in suggesting they were part of the BCATP. Some of them trained on the BCATP, but they set up their own scheme in Toronto. There was a little place called Little Norway, and down on the right in downtown Toronto, and adjacent to the Island Airport, which is practically across the road from the Royal York Hotel, as you know. They had their own training facility there and trained their own crews, and had another auxiliary station up in Muskoka. So theirs was a somewhat of a separate operation, but allied, as we had a lot. I had quite a few dealings with them, providing them with their guns and ammunition. And, yeah, I didn't mention ammunition before. That was another important acquisition we had to take care of. I might tell you something about that if you remind me a bit later. All right. I guess that's enough to give you some idea of the build-up of the directorate. It grew a bit more after that, but that was the way we started out. Now, as I say, the British Commonwealth here at Champagne, and I'll have more to say about it in detail later, was so big, and the number of schools so great, and not amount of equipment required so extensive, that we had to constantly be developing new scales of equipment and new schedules of spare parts and so on, and getting the approval of these from the highest authority in the Air Force before sending them over to munitions and supply for action. We didn't wait by any means for the final signing of the agreement, the BCATP agreement, and that took a long time. I don't think the Canadian public realized that there were a lot of problems in working out the detail of that. And indeed, it wasn't until mid-December, a little after mid-December, that that agreement was finally signed. And there was quite a bit of acrimony in certain stages of the working out of the details. But, be that as it may, it was quite obvious that the plan was going to go ahead. And therefore, we didn't have to wait for the final agreement. We started right off in September, because some of those things had a long lead time in acquisition. Set up the facilities of manufacture, greatly expand the number of machine guns, or manufacture machine guns you'd not manufactured before, or even to acquire machine guns from some other source, and, for example, took a long time. Same thing with bomb sites and gun sites.
I suppose much of the equipment with which they were manufactured came from the States.
And from the UK.
Mm-hmm.
So, I remember, I'll just give you an example of some of the problems. This is a sort of a simple example, but it was obvious that we required a vast number of camera guns. Because the camera gun was used in the early stages of the armament training. Camera guns were operated by the same trigger mechanism, or similar trigger mechanism as the machine gun. In many cases, the same mechanism. And there were camera guns and camera guns. There were camera guns that represent the fixed guns in the wing of a fighter. There were camera guns to represent the free moving guns of the bomber and so on. They were quite different devices, but at any rate, they all took pictures. They took photographs of the target, be it an aircraft or be it a ground target and so on. They were expensive little items.
I can believe, yeah.
And they weren't mass-produced the way a camera, ordinary camera is. They were made to look like weapons, and when you load it, for example, I had one that looked like a Lewis gun, and when you put that drum on there that looked like the ammunition drum, it was the film you were plucking on there, and so on. And, everything you did was representative of what you do when you handled your other regular weapon. Well, before very long, I realized that these camera guns might be a hold-up because there wasn't any at that time, any real optical industry in Canada. The United States wasn't at war, and I really didn't know what sort of problem we'd face there in getting that type of equipment from the States. And there was always the problem of getting stuff across the Atlantic with the German submarines.
Yes, yes.
And so we were off the mark pretty quickly. And I think the first major requisition that I developed and took forward for approval was had to do with camera guns. And I think it probably was one, only the first of several, perhaps, that were put forward as time went on. But this one required the purchase of $1 million worth of camera guns. Well, now, $1 million doesn't sound much today, in today's world, but in 1939, it was a lot of money. And in 1939, in the services, it was a great deal of money, because don't forget, it was only a few years since I told Vogt on the, well, in the Depression years, it was only $1.5 million.
Right.
And the mentality of the staff officer at Air Force headquarters was still an economy mentality. Everyone was being very penny-pinching, even after war broke out. There was sort of a reluctance to go. Had been constrained for so long that you couldn't let yourself go and spend very much money without looking over your shoulder to make sure there was enough there to spend. I took this carefully developed requisition into Bredner. And I remember getting myself very well prepared for that briefing. Because I had to sell him, he was my immediate superior, on the need for immediate action on this, without delay, to get on with it. Well, he was a great big, rough fellow on the exterior. He had a real heart, but he had a big, boomy voice and a huge man. He could look a little bit formidable. I went in there and argued the case for this. And he finally said, "Well, you made a good case there. And done my piece, and it rather shakes me to see that amount of money spent on that sort of thing at just this juncture, but you've convinced me that it's necessary and that we have to have these in order to get on with the commitments under the training plan." So he said, "I'm prepared to initial this, and you can take it on to the Chief of the Air Staff." Now, I must have looked a bit aghast at this, because it wasn't my place to take these things up.
He was really passing the buck, wasn't he?
And indeed, up to that point, I had had very few contacts with the CAS, Coyle. He was somewhat inaccessible. And when he saw the expression on my face, he started to laugh. He said, "You know, you may think that it would be easy for me to put this across the way you've convinced me." But he said it just wouldn't be, because he's been so used to saying no to me for the last 18 months or 2 years, that it would come almost automatically. And he said, "I would go in there and I wouldn't have all the answers at my fingertips, because you've actually developed this. And it would be..." He said, "Psychologically, it would be better for you to take this in." And he said, "If you don't convince him, I'll come with you on the second go. But you take it in to Bredner, to Coyle." So it was arranged that I go up and see Coyle. Well, he was a Scot, a Canadian, but a Scotch background. He had been very careful of the public funds all the time he'd been responsible for the operation of the RCAF. He was absolutely dumbfounded when I put this thing before him. Absolutely dumbfounded. He had never spent $1 million in his life. He never authorized anyone else to spend $1 million in his life. And I could see it was going to be tough going, so I carried on with the same line that I'd had with Brenda, and finally, after a lot of questions, you know, he was very, very cautious. He said, "Well, I'll think about it. I'll think about it." He said, "I'll you arrange with my secretary to come back and see me this time tomorrow, and we'll have further chat." Well, I guess, I don't know what happened in the interval. He probably did talk to Brett. And Brenda could handle him pretty well. And he was one of those who could deal with Croyle. So I guess between the two of them and the strength of my pitch, too, the scales tipped. And I was in the next day. And with great, great agony, he finally agreed and put his signature on there. And that was one of the great triumphs of my early days of war, was to get that. You see, once you got that first one through, from then on, it wasn't me. I had lots of major ones after that, dealing with machine guns and bomb sites and gun sites. Those are all very expensive items. And bombs. Bombs were very costly things, damn expensive. And practice bombs. And I mean, didn't have a requisition for practice bombs again. I thought he was going to dance with me. Break down and weep in his beard. You know, it was such an expensive thing. They were only worth $10 a piece, but you used them in tremendous quantities with a vast number of trainees. I've forgotten exactly how many. Gunners and bomb aimers were to be trained, but it was about the output of the training plan. I'll get around to that later on when we talk about the training plan. But you're only dealing in tens of thousands of students in that particular category who would be using those weapons. And of course, even the pilots use some bombs in dive bombing. You know, everybody uses them. All told, there are 130,000 air crew produced under BCATP, and every one of them. Used practice bombs at some time or other, so I could see the number that were. You had to drop an awful lot in order to get any degree of confidence. So there was a huge bill for practice bombs.
It must have boggled his mind a bit to deal with those numbers.
It certainly did.
Yes.
Well, yeah. That was my first big success in negotiating a deal. So, with those few remarks, I think that I'm going to turn to one or two other aspects of the activities of my office. One that I should mention to you had to do with invention. Naturally, when there's a great crisis facing the nation, people get all sorts of weird and wonderful ideas about how they can develop new devices and new weapons to help win the war, which is a good thing. Everybody's doing a bit of active thinking about doing something themselves personally to contribute to war effort, even those that are not in a position to serve themselves and the forces. So you have a great flood of inventions. Now, I was on the inventions committee. It was a committee composed, and I think there was one member from the Army, Navy, Air Force, and the Judge Advocate General's Department and National Research Council. That sort of composition. Probably somebody from the Munitions and Supplies, I can't remember that detail. We had some scurrious ideas. You know, you get people submitting ideas that haven't any technical competence whatsoever, but they've got an active brain. They can't sleep very well at night, and up comes some ideas. So probably for every one sensible, suppose that you get $1,000 that are absolutely nonsensical. That sounds like a terrible exaggeration, but I don't think it's too far off the mark. It means that somebody's got to do an awful lot of screening to sort these out, and everybody has to be dealt with as though they have a brilliant idea, but let down a bit lightly when it's a stupid one. For example, I remember one chap who came to see me. He traveled some distance, too, because he was so convinced that this was an event that was going to affect the course of the war. And his idea was that and it had to do with aerial combat, and therefore came to my attention. We had a secretary of this committee that sorted these out and sent them to the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, or research councils, depending on whether they appeared to apply to any of those places in particular. This fellow came at some distance to personally describe the details of his brilliant idea, very simple little invention, which consisted of placing hemispherical metal cups on the trailing edges of all the wings and the tail surfaces of the aircraft. So installed that the bullet on entering the open hemispherical cup would be turned 180 degrees and go back and hit the person that fired them. I had the greatest difficulty explaining, trying to let this fellow know that it really wasn't a feasible proposition, but not discouraging him too much, because you never know when something like that might come up with something. Sensible, mm-hmm. You don't really think too much, have too much hope of that with a chap with that type of idea. But that fellow was so persistent, I didn't think I'd ever get rid of him. He wanted to get other opinions. He wouldn't take my words. There's no technical competence behind most of these things.
Did you ever find someone who, people who were competent, who did produce sort of working models and before they appeared on the scene? Or
rarely. Most of these were little things scratched out on a piece of wrapping paper or a white sheet of paper on a little letter describing what it was all about. But occasionally you'd have something much more complex involved. Actually, that reminds me, there was a case that I should tell you about. And this happened in, I think we're right in saying, it happened in late 39, or perhaps early 40, but it was right towards the end of that. It was during the first few months of the war, anyway. The Minister of Defense was Norman MacLeod Rogers. It was before he was killed. Remember, he was killed in the flying accident.
Yes, I knew his boys, actually.
Oh, did you?
In Kingston, yeah.
Did you? Oh, yeah, of course. He was a college professor at Queens, wasn't he?
Yeah.
And he'd been a college professor at my university before he went to Queens, so he was known. I'd never taken any classes from him. I knew him just by sight in those college days. But he got in touch with the members of the Inventions Committee, or his office did, and said that there was a team of inventors in town. I guess I shouldn't call it a team, there were two of them, two inventors in town, who had arrived with the highest recommendations and arrived from the States. And they'd come on the recommendation of the president of General Electric. And they had done some inventions work for GE. And they had an idea that was going to revolutionize anti-submarine warfare. As such, it was of great importance to me, and interest to me, and to the Navy, but also to anybody concerned with the war effort. So it was arranged that we would get together with this group. They arrived on a Friday afternoon, and they went. They had a letter to the Prime Minister. They went right to the Prime Minister.
Oh, my gosh.
And the Prime Minister put them on to Norman MacLeod Rogers. And it was agreed that we would meet with these fellows. We met with them on a Saturday. Navy was represented by Admiral Murray. The Army by George Morrison. There was sort of my opposite number over there, Brigadier General George Morrison, Brigadier, as they called him in those days. The JAG was represented by Reggie Ord, who for many, many years was the JAG, the head lawyer. And I've forgotten who was there, George Field or somebody that was there from the National Research Council. There was somebody from, at that meeting, from Munitions and Supply. I guess it was still called the War Purchase. What'd they call it? Forgotten. War Production or something like that. They had,
yes,
they had a different term.
Hadn't been organized.
War Supply.
That point,
yeah,
I think, yeah.
That's right. Well, at any rate, we were given a presentation by these fellows. But it was a most peculiar presentation, because they were guarding their secret. They weren't going to tell us the
details. Really?
I don't know who they were if we didn't take up their proposal. Perhaps they had the idea that maybe they would do business with the U.S. government or some other government. Or maybe if we didn't, then they would go to the U.K. authorities. But there was a lot of money involved. The proposition was a clear one. They had in their preamble to their presentation, they said they made a flat statement that they had an invention that would win the war. They had an invention that, without question, would destroy submarines on the first attempt, first attack. They refused to provide specific detail because they were afraid of losing out on patent rights and so on. They hadn't had a chance to go through the patents procedure. But they made a proposition something like this, that if we would have...